Toynbee says, quote, "The two-sidedness of death is a fundamental feature of death. There are always two parties to a death, the person who dies and the survivors who are bereaved. That is, as I see it, the capital fact about the relation between living and dying. There are two parties to the suffering that death inflicts, and in the apportionment of the suffering, the survivor takes the brunt." Close quote from Toynbee. Even if we wanted to, neither Dr. Saz nor I could deny the cold sociological truth that some modes of death are more stigmatizing to the survivors than are other modes of death. And generally speaking, suicide imposes the greatest stigma of all upon its survivors. The concept, my concept of postvention, of working with survivor victims, is relevant here. The physician John Hinton, professor of psychiatry in Great Britain, in his book Dying, says the following, quote, "The unexpected death from suicide brings great distress to the bereaved," and I needn't quote this to make this point. I believe, as I hope Dr. Saz would believe, in the value of peak experiences and self-actualization. Those felicitous concepts of Abe Maslow, the opposite of despair, human degradation, ennui, and emotional flatness. To be actualized, to do the most one can with one's own capacities, to live a full life, seems to be a beautiful positive goal. There ought to be more of it in this world. On that topic, I have a warm anecdote to share. 2 weeks before Abe Maslow's death, 2 years ago, he dictated a note on the topic of death, which appeared subsequently in Psychology Today, into a recording machine in my study at the Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences, overlooking the lake and the oak trees behind the Stanford campus. He was then living nearby, came occasionally to visit the center. We talked that afternoon about what he called his bonus life, by which he meant his life after his previous coronary attack. With great feeling, he related how he savored each day with his wife, his children, especially his grandchildren, his friends, with trees and with clouds. Somewhere along the line, not unexpectedly, I asked him about suicide, specifically whether the act of suicide could ever represent the self-actualization of a person, as Hillman has asserted in his imprudent book, Suicide and the Soul. Maslow shook his large head in the negative. Insight and pain, he said, were to be lived through. Self-actualization was an exhilarating experience. Suicide was its antithesis in that it terminated experience. Suicide, in some cases, could represent understandable escape from intolerable pain, but it could never be self-actualization. Personally, I was moved by what he said, but it was not new to me. It was a position I believed then and hold today. Suicide prevention is neither myth nor mandate. It is a human opportunity for those who have the third ear to hear it, to respond to a cry for help from an individual with sharpened ambivalence, or a person concerned about that individual, who calls from a pit of inner and dyadic philosophic and emotional crisis. Suicide prevention obviously should not be indifferent to the fate of those who come to seek for help. Dr. Saz is correct in his implied or implicit accusations on this score. I believe that we should try to do almost anything to keep a highly lethal suicidal person out of a coroner's office. For if we did not, it might then be too late and there would be no one except the survivors to help. Now, the central issues both are and are not questions of rights or liberties. Any capable adult has the undeniable right to kill himself. It is a right that can hardly be frustrated in action, and it is irreversible. But if we speak of rights, we must keep in mind that the potential survivors also have their rights. Most pointedly, the psychological right to lead a life unstigmatized by a suicidal death. We reflect that the saving of one life can directly affect for good the mental health of the next generation by preventing the deprivation of a parent figure. And in the same vein, liberty is always tempered by the living and psychological space needs of others. To give a simplest example, my right to utter a certain loaded four-letter word in this auditorium is, and I believe should be, severely truncated by a number of possible inimical social consequences. That word is F-I-R-E. Nor is the issue... Nor is the issue essentially one of control. If we can believe that not all intervention is necessarily malicious, then there can be benign intervention, characterized by interest and empathy, concentrated, a concerned interaction in which control is neither the primary issue nor the threat. Today, built largely on the work in the last 20 years, it was possible because no one took Dr. Saad's position on this topic seriously. We know a great deal about the clues, prodromal signs, and premonitory indices of suicide. These signals, both verbal and behavioral, provide us the handles for benign intervention. Suicide prevention needs both advocates and critics, and I am sure can profit from the comments of even unfriendly critics. But I see no useful purposes served by broadcast accusations that have the weakest factual base, I'm going to explicate this, and rest on convoluted combinations of shaky premises. Dr. Saz refers once in his article directly to me, that article, The Ethics of Suicide. Here quoted verbatim is what he says about me. Quote, for example, Philip Solomon writes in the Journal of the American Medical Association, 1967, that we must protect the patient from his own suicidal wishes. While to Edwin Schneidman, suicide prevention is like fire prevention, Bulletin of Suicidology, 68. Solomon thus reduces the would-be suicide to the level of an unruly child, while Schneidman reduces him to the level of a tree. Close quote. Anyone who knows the slightest thing about me or my work knows that Dr. Saz's statement is nonsensical sawdust. that even if what he said were true, which is sheer claptrap, I would rather do that than encourage anyone's irresponsibility to chop trees down. One ought to believe in human ecology. I would ask, without people, do falling trees make a sound? Further, one ought to know that statement is unfairly used, and that quoted remark is taken entirely out of context. The point that I was making was that a decent citizen, it's in the text, need not be constantly preoccupied with suicide and suicide prevention, but as in the case of fire, if someone saw the potentials for a blaze, he ought, as part of his general civic responsibility, take some appropriate interventive action. The intellectual unfairness of that general style of attack seriously troubles me in this matter. I need to say that at a university and in the world of science, there are generally levels of responsibility that go with being a scholar or professional person. One does not quote out of context, misrepresent, and speaking of fire, make frequent use of inflammatory language. Dr. Saz's best-known book, The Myth of Mental Illness, as a cogent analysis of hysteria as other than disease, was a brilliant and persuasive exposition which touched a responding chord in many sophisticated readers, including me. I recall reading it and marveling at his breadth of knowledge. Knowing nothing more than the positive reviews which that book received, deservedly, and seeing the book everywhere in bookstores in paperback, I cannot believe that he as author received a great deal of positive reinforcement from that achievement. Perhaps he thought to extend those kudos and to find similar success by employing the same kind of approach and leveling the same attacks in fields other than hysteria. For example, the fields of drug addiction and suicide prevention. We shall hear, because I'm going to quote, what Dr. Sidney Cohn, how he assesses Dr. Saz's work in the field of drug addiction. In brief, to give a preview, that it's filled with error and obfuscation. As a suicidologist, I am concerned that Dr. Saz is almost meretricious when he attempts to apply the outlines of his earlier incisive critique of hysteria as disease to suicidal phenomena. Historically, phenomenologically, psychologically, sociologically, epistemologically, these two are quite different. But in this setting today, I am not debating the myth of mental illness. Our topic here today relates specifically to suicide and suicide prevention. As far as I'm concerned, the text under discussion today is the article entitled The Ethics of Suicide, which you have, printed in the 1971 Antioch Review and reprinted in the Intellectual Digest. Without discussing the book, The Myth of Mental Illness, in detail at all, I am not so timid as to withhold stating my position on the issue of suicide as mental illness, and even my position on the question of disturbed mental life as mental illness, or as medical illness, a volatile droplet from which Dr. Saz has derived much extended mileage. Is, as Dr. Saz accuses psychiatry of saying, inner disturbance mental illness? Is psychic perturbation mental illness? Now, here's a relevant quotation concerning schizophrenia as mental illness. I'll quote, somewhat extended quote. How shall we define schizophrenia? Is schizophrenia, as Kraepelin believed, a mental disease process resulting from an auto-intoxication, etc., etc.? Or is it, from Arrietty, a disease characterized by primitive forms of rationality, etc.? Or from Franz Alexander, is it an illness in which the ego loses its synthetic function of harmonizing different instinctual demands, etc.? Or from Jung, does the peculiarity of this disease lie in the startling emergence of archaic materials, etc.? Or is schizophrenia, as Adolf Meyer felt, to be thought of as a disease, etc.? Or do we really understand the delusions of a schizophrenic illness as projection of repressed passive homosexual desires? I'm still quoting. All these are concepts, but there are happily three solidly known facts about schizophrenia. They are, one, we do not know exactly how to cure it. Its remediation is unknown. Second, we do not know exactly what causes it. Its etiology is unknown, except when we say that it is cryptogenic. And third, we do not know its nature. We do not know what it is. If it isn't it, which it undoubtedly ain't, it certainly is not a disease. Close quote. I am obliged to confess that I am the author of those mortal lines, and that they appeared in print 2 years before The Myth of Mental Illness. Obviously, I'm not quibbling with Dr. Saz on that point. On that issue, I was chronologically at least ahead of him. He and I can agree that mental perturbation is not a disease. Do we need to continue to beat that drum? If so, let's play it together. But, in the years since, Dr. Saz has increasingly committed what I shall here label as a violation of Benjamin Franklin's maxim. That canon, taken from Franklin's famous letter to a young man, setting forth that in the absence of marriage there are some discernible advantages to having an older mistress, contains the gritty line that every knack being by practice capable of improvement. But alas, each time Dr. Saz rewrote the main thesis of the myth of mental illness in his subsequent books entitled Pain and Pleasure, Law, Liberty, and Psychiatry, The Ethics of Psychoanalysis and Psychiatric Justice, he said many of these same things over and over, but instead of improving them with practice, as Franklin had suggested, he permitted himself, as he continually rewrote this initially important idea, to take increasingly untenable positions beyond the limits of logical acceptance. What started as a sound myth has become, for suicidologists at any rate, a shrill nightmare. His recent pronouncement on drugs and on suicide prevention attacks the range of common sense confidence. I want to read from these recent works. The recent paper on the ethics of addiction, published last year in the American Journal of Psychiatry, is an example. Now, we need to keep our minds on his style. An examination of his style is a key to our understanding of the pervasive fragility of his assertions. As we shall see, he, and I guess I too, is an interesting verbal infighter. The editors of the American Journal of Psychiatry asked Dr. Sidney Cohn to respond to Dr. Saz's article on addiction. I don't know a thing about that topic. I simply quote this. Dr. Cohn, as some of you may know, is an expert on drugs. He's the author of the Beyond Within, other books. He was director of the NIMH Institute, the Division for Drug Abuse. And for those of you who know him personally, he's a moderate and temperate physician. Here are just a few sentences from the first section of Dr. Cohn's commentary on Dr. Saz's The Ethics of Addiction. I'm quoting now for the next few minutes. While reading The Ethics of Addiction, two impulses arise. One is to meticulously dissect this fine exemplar of sophistry and strawmanship. The other is to deal constructively with the issues that are raised. For a decade or so, Dr. Saz has been busily setting up psychiatric straw men and seditiously demolishing them. The technique is worth examining in the context of the article under consideration. The game rules are simple. All this is quoted. One, find a definition vulnerable to easy demolition. Two, argue by analogy. Much of the paper is devoted to a discourse on sex and religion, replete with free-floating attempts to transfer conclusions to those areas of drug dependence. Reasoning by analogy is entertaining, but it's always a hazardous procedure. Why not base one's contention directly with drug dependence? Three, berate outmoded long since abandoned activities. This tactic is commonly known as flogging a dead horse. Four, make partially true accusations, but imply they are universally true. Five, attack currently unpopular targets. The medical profession, an authoritarian symbol, is a fine object to vilify these days. One can only conclude, I'm still quoting, that Dr. Saz does not read newspapers, magazines, or books, or does not listen to lectures or the radio, nor look at television or the library of films on any conceivable medical subject prepared for the layman. One is left with the vague feeling that Dr. Saz knows a great deal, but not necessarily about drug addiction. That's the end of the quotation. That's from Dr. Sidney Cohn, to which, with whatever credentials I might muster in suicidology, I would add that if possible, he knows even less about suicide prevention. The assertion that suicide is seen as a disease by American professionals is crucial to this house of cards syllogism, so I must deal with it in some detail. I'll quote from Dr. Saz. He says, it is difficult to find responsible medical or psychiatric authority today that does not regard suicide as a medical problem. I'm still quoting. For example, Ilse Wieth, the noted medical historian writing in Modern Medicine, asserts that the act of suicide clearly represents an illness. Bernard Schockett, a psychiatrist at the University of Maryland, offers a precise description of the kind of illness it is. He then quotes two other psychiatrists. Following this, he says, quote, many other psychiatric authorities could be cited to illustrate the current unanimity of this view of suicide, close quote. That is simply nonsensical, I tell you. He has obviously found what he has sought. There is no unanimity. The honest fact is that the vast majority of current authorities on suicide believe quite the opposite. Dr. Saz's major premise is false. Now let me cite some current authorities. I'll begin by citing a couple encyclopedias. The current Encyclopedia Britannica says suicide is an act of voluntary, intentional self-destruction. I've read that piece carefully. There's nothing about mental illness in it. From the International Encyclopedia of the Social Sciences, suicide is a human act of self-inflicted, self-intention cessation. I've read that piece carefully. There's nothing about mental illness there either. If we turn to another expert, the past president of the American Association of Suicidology, an author of substantial books and monographs in this field, Dr. Avery Weissman, interestingly enough, his recent presidential address was called Is Suicide a Disease? The first paragraph reads as follows, I quote from it. suicide is neither a moral dilemma nor a mental disease, but a form of life-threatening behavior resembling a declaration of war or a petition for bankruptcy. There is no evidence of an organic disease to explain it. Close quote. There's no tirade on suicide as disease there. I have more pages on this. I quote from Paul Friedman's book on suicide. The serious students of suicide have either eschewed or openly repudiated this point of view. A recent substantial book on the psychology of suicide defines suicide as those enigmatic acts of self-destruction, events which are neither exclusively of the psyche nor of society, but are events that can be best understood in terms of an admixture of both as socio-psychological phenomena. No talk of mental illness. In a recent symposium of suicide, with some acknowledged experts on this topic, Dublin, Friedman, Kuby, Menninger, Stengel, a book entitled On the Nature of Suicide, no one in that volume discussed suicide as a mental disease or sickness. And further in that volume, several distinguished panelists, Farber, Douglas, Bakken, Girard, discussed suicide in the will to claim that these experts talked of suicide as illness or they failed to recognize the significance of freedom would, as Dr. Weissman pointed out in a comment about that book, contradict their principal thesis. Now, to assert that suicide is a disease is either sloppy scholarship or hopelessly anachronistic, or patently selective in the choice of materials. And if the premises are inaccurate, what credence can we put in the conclusions? Now, I want to return to the paper on drugs once more. Dr. Sidney Cohn says, and I'll quote him, "To assume that Dr. Saws does not recognize these and other logical fallacies, semantic ploys, inappropriate analogies, and internal contradictions is not tenable. He perceives them as readily as his readers do. The question becomes, why make such sensational, unsound statements? They are made, I suspect, to stimulate, to irritate, to fracture our fixed cognitive set, to force us to rethink our established positions." Well, apparently I am more puzzled and no doubt less gracious than Dr. Cohn. There are aspects of me that believe that in some respects Dr. Saws does not recognize some of the logical fallacies that he consistently commits. Using a method of analyzing the idiosyncrasies of reasoning and cognitive maneuvers, the aspects of logic embedded in an individual's text, a method which I've developed over the past decade with a colleague, a mathematical logician, Dr. Peter Tripodes, we analyze the main features of Dr. Saws' logical style in The Ethics of Suicide. As a short aside, I should mention that I have been using this method for the past decade with various materials, including an analysis of the 1960 Kennedy-Nixon debates, Khrushchev and Macmillan, Senator Joe McCarthy, and a number of suicide note materials, each of whom, as you can see, has come either to a tragic or unsuccessful end. There's a subtlety in there. Okay. There's the most recent description of this method, for those of you who are interested, appears in a book, 1969, edited by Professor George Gerbner of Pennsylvania, entitled The Analysis of Communication Content. The results of our analysis of Dr. Saws' logical styles are very interesting. We tabulated this. We went through the text sentence by sentence. To put it simply, I'll put it in a page, our 20-page analysis. To put it simply, the text is filled with argumentum ad populum and complex question. I have here definitions, explications, and illustrations of these points. I'll skip them in this presentation. But mostly, the analysis of Dr. Saws' paper on suicide leads me to say that he comes across as being oxymoronic. Now, before you gasp, thinking that I am impugning his fine intelligence, I hasten to state that an oxymoron is defined as a combination of contradictory or incongruous words used for epigrammatic effect. The one example given in the Webster's Dictionary of oxymoron is cruel kindness. It describes Dr. Saz's position rather well. In the English literature, perhaps the best-known oxymoronic passages appear in Romeo and Juliet. O heavy lightness, serious vanity, feather of lead, bright smoke, cold fire, sick health, beautiful tyrant, fiend angelical, and parting is such sweet sorrow. Dr. Saz's basic oxymoronic position is as follows. It has the compassion of concern combined with the possibility of disregard. It invokes the image of a savior of disinterest, a saint of turning one's back, one that might let you drown in a sea of his high principle. While it espouses liberty, it contains a perversion, I believe, of the notion of democracy. By forgetting the basic psychological truth that not all pairs of human beings are equally needful at any given time, like parent and infant, healer and sick, helper and perturbed, therapist and potentially suicidally inclined person. There is the flavor in it of the double-binding pseudo-rescuer. As a physician, it seems to be saying, come, let me be indifferent to your ultimate fate. As a psychiatrist, it seems to be saying, come, let me disregard your keenest ambivalences. As a citizen, it seems to be saying, come, let me be deaf to your cry for help. Dr. Saz further says that they, physicians, when they are threatened by an individual suicide, quote, strike and strike back hard. I'm still quoting. This explains why psychiatrists and suicidologists resort, apparently with a perfectly clear conscience, to the vilest methods. They must believe that their lofty end justifies the basest means. Hence the prevalent use of force and fraud in suicide prevention. Close quote. Now my reflection is that the language of the amphitheater is always exciting. The question for this different arena is whether that kind of language is appropriate, fair, reasonable, or sensible. What function does it really serve? There's an attempt in that article to discredit by association suicide prevention with evil, force, fraud, deception. That style tends to bully the readers. I believe Dr. Saz certainly has the courage of his own confusions. To quote further from that article, one of the more demagogic sentences, quote, the suicidologist stands Patrick Henry's famous exclamation, give me liberty or give me death on its head. I'm quoting. In effect, he says, give him commitment, give him electroshock, give him lobotomy, give him lifelong slavery, but do not let him choose death. He further says, quote, the pseudo-medical perspective is then used to justify psychiatric deception and coercion of the crudest sort. I'm quoting, I understand that deception is standard practice in suicide prevention centers, though this is often denied. Close quote. As some of you may know, I was co-director of a suicide prevention center for some years and then head of a national program on this topic. I don't know what he's talking about when he screams, the printed text is filled with his italics, about lobotomy, shock, and slavery. Most of the actual suicide prevention in this country, almost all of it in Great Britain, is done by non-professional volunteers in suicide prevention and crisis centers and in the Samaritans. To my knowledge, not one of them has ever administered or prescribed an electric coma or performed a lobotomy. Is this a cruel and uninformed way of making broadside pejorative allegations? To me, those statements seem much more shocking and slashing than any actions practiced in the name of humanity by the benign targets of this overdetermined abuse. I'm not sure we stand to profit much from uninformed, non-suicidologists accusing us incorrectly about practicing deception as standard practice. Now, because that article quotes from Patrick Henry, I am emboldened to extend this lesson in American history to clarify the syntax. The speech given on March 23, 1775, at the Second Virginia Convention in Richmond reads as follows. I'll read it to you. "Gentlemen may cry peace, peace, but there is no peace. The war has actually begun. The next gale that sweeps from the north will bring to our ears the clash of resounding arms. Our brethren are already in the field. Is life so dear or peace so sweet as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery? Forbid it, Almighty God. I know not what course others may take, but for me, give me liberty or give me death." That's the end of the quote. As an amateur student of American history, it seems evident to me that "give me liberty or give me death" was never meant as a simple alternative. Dr. Saez is confused again about that conjunction. Patrick Henry's statement was meant as a credo, a challenge, a battle cry. It does not say, "If you do not give me liberty, then please give me death." Rather, it declares specifically to the then English king that you had better give us liberty or we shall fight for our liberty. Liberty and life are on both sides of that conjunction. I puzzle as to why Dr. Saz's position precludes putting life on both sides of his compound sentences. Now, the concluding remarks in the suicide article that he wrote and that you have relate to this theme, quote, that in the final analysis, the would-be suicide is like the would-be immigrant. Both want to leave where they are and move elsewhere. The suicide wants to leave life and embrace death. The immigrant wants to leave his homeland and settle in another country. And he says further, "Let us take this analogy seriously. The medical profession's stance toward suicide is like the communist toward immigration. If suicide," I'm still quoting, "is an illness because it terminates in death, then if the prevention of death by any means necessary is the physician's therapeutic mandate, then the proper remedy for suicide is indeed liberty side." That's the end of the quote. The opposite of suicide prevention is not, as is asserted, liberty side. I'll mention etymologically, actually the word should be libricide. The relationship between suicide prevention and immigration prevention is not isomorphic. The analogy is strained. One can, theoretically at least, emigrate and immigrate both ways. Expatriates can, if conditions change or in another time, return to their homeland. One moves to obtain a better life, otherwise one might kill oneself instead of emigrating. But one cannot possibly move reversibly between life and death. It is one way, irremediable, irreversible. I assume that almost everybody, including every psychiatrist, and I'm tempted to say with one possible exception, knows this fundamental fact. And further, suicide prevention does not kill an individual's liberty. In some cases, it may temporarily trade a diminution of his liberties for a prolonged life. That argument tries to seduce us with an artificial dichotomy, kill versus life, where a realistic and temperate description of a continuum would have been much more accurate and fair. And I remind us all of us immigrants, that exchange, the temporary diminution of some liberties for an extension of the duration and the scope of life, is the principal hallmark of civilized social order, where liberty, even where it is not optimally practiced, is continually prized. The issue of suicide prevention and civil liberties is obviously one of our key topics. Dr. Saz is right on the mark and deserves our gratitude for having focused attention on some important contemporary civic problems. When he raises questions about the right to be different, or what Nicholas Kittrey calls the problem of defiance, or what Perry London has called personal liberty and behavior control, he re-echoes the concerns of many of us. But in one's frenzy to rush forward through the trees with one's torch, one has to beware of the risk of burning down that forest. On this issue, we we can see with crystal clarity common goal. Now, I want to quote another paragraph from Dr. Saws. Dr. Saws says, for the sake of emphasis, and I might say this is just after he has said suicide prevention is erroneous and evil because it serves to legitimize psychiatric fraud and force, but I'm now quoting him again, let me state that I consider counseling, persuasion, psychotherapy, or any other voluntary measure, especially for persons troubled by their own suicidal inclinations or seeking such help, unobjectionable and indeed generally desirable interventions. That's from Dr. Saws. If he is for persuasion, including the persuasion to live, what then are the relationships between persuasion and voluntary measures? How persuasive can one be before he borders on being coercive and invades the other's capacity to act voluntarily? How is voluntary to be defined? Does it preclude ambivalence, unconscious elements? It would appear that both he and those of us toward whom some of this criticism is directed equally have the delicate tasks of dealing with nuances, quantities, degrees, amounts. A great deal depends on benign human factors, on how considerate, sensitive, and democratically oriented the hands on the rheostats are in those vital human interactions. In relation to civil liberties, a key issue for Dr. Saws and for me, I believe that I truly appreciate the impulse that motivates those statements. We have much more in common in our approach to this topic than he could know. If I believe that in the balance, that prepositional phrase is critical, that in the balance, suicide prevention did more harm in the way of abridging civil liberties or to the personalities involved than it did good in saving lives, I would endorse everything that he had said. Most of the suicidologists I know personally, myself included, are rather concerned with civil liberties. In the statement of one's position, however, I think that one should attempt to avoid the excessive language of overkill and megaddiction. As you might imagine, we in suicide prevention have been ever concerned with the issues of civil liberties. Currently, in the American Association of Suicidology, there are individuals, Dr. Richard Seiden, who is here, for one, addressing themselves to specific issues relating to the invasion of privacy, confidentiality, and so on. The ethical standards being prepared by Jerome Motto, Nancy Allen, Charlotte Ross, Richard Brooks, probably be discussed this afternoon, are much concerned with ethical issues and the issues of civil liberty as they relate to suicide prevention. I recall some years ago when I was at the Los Angeles Suicide Prevention Center, we, Doctors Littman, Tabachnik, Farbrow, arranged for a consultation with a well-known civil libertarian, a prominent and currently active attorney for the American Civil Liberties Union. He came to the center, and for part of a day, we put a number of questions to him, many that anticipated Dr. Saws's concerns, and all of which reflected our own concerns. In essence, as I recall it, he said that if we acted in a citizen's best interests, using our best professional judgment, he could not view that as an abridgment of the citizen's civil liberties. In citing this, I am not trying to prove a case. I am simply reporting our continuing concern with this topic. No one can say that suicidologists are unmindful of it. I reflect that in general, as I know the studies on the authoritarian personality and related topics, that I would surmise that individuals who go into suicide prevention, either as professionals or as volunteers, are by and large, admittedly with some conspicuous exceptions, on the liberal civil libertarian side. Indeed, I would believe they are especially concerned with the individual's liberty, his psychological rights to continue to live in the face of oppressive inner and outer torment. To dimensionalize the problem as civil libertarian versus suicidologist would not be accurate. Indeed, it may well be that suicidologists, by practicing suicide prevention, are operationally, indeed, among the most effective civil libertarians in the world. Now, a word about Marilyn Monroe, which I had deleted, but which I'll now put in. Dr. Saz says in this article, he says, quote, "Indeed, although I cannot support this claim with statistics, I believe that accepted psychiatric methods of suicide prevention often aggravate rather than ameliorate the suicidal person's problems. As one reads the tragic encounters with psychiatry of people like James Forrestal, Marilyn Monroe, or Ernest Hemingway, one gains the impression that they felt demeaned and deeply hurt by the psychiatric indignities inflicted upon them, and that as a result of these experiences, they are even more desperately driven to suicide." That's the end of that paragraph. That paragraph, if not inaccurate, is certainly unkind. But let us, for a moment, assume that position and believe that it were so. Still other reactions can come to mind. It is still possible to point out the iatrogenic effects and untoward results in some field of endeavor without issuing a broadside indictment or a call for the dismemberment of that field. Criticisms ought to lead to recommendations for sharpening techniques and for reducing errors to the lowest possible number. Would we seriously think of abandoning anesthesiology or surgery because of the occasional obvious failures in these procedures? I have to wonder if Dr. Saz's students have had undiluted success in their therapeutic efforts. And if they have, we must all learn from them. But if they have not, we welcome them to the club. However, hoping they won't burn it down, at least not until they've developed some realistic plans for a better structure. Whether or not a person with suicidal thoughts or impulses is called a client or a patient may be a semantic detail. But the clinical suicidologist, whether he is psychiatrist, social worker, psychologist, volunteer, physician, clergyman, cannot abrogate his position, invested in him by the suicidal person who comes to him for help, of standing in locum tenens as part witch doctor, part physician, part healer, part magician, part parent, part friend. If the therapist cannot stand the transference, he should get out of the office. Which leads me to a related thought, that the therapist's countertransference ought to have only the smallest possible components of hostility and disinterest. There is little room for moral ennui on the part of potential rescuers. In his article, Dr. Saz says, "Nor do I advocate teaching doctors suicide prevention, whatever that may be." If I may end on a personal note, I respectfully suggest that Dr. Saz ought to learn what suicide prevention might be. As a past president of the American Association of Suicidology, I would personally welcome him into the association and look forward to his stimulating participation. In the end, after all these words of mine and quotations from Dr. Saz and my comments about them, there remains one key operational issue which I now put to you in the form of the following question. Could you, in good conscience, send for help a highly lethal suicidal loved one to someone who espouses Dr. Saz's position, assuming, of course, that you yourself were not ambivalent about that person's living or dying?
Well, I think that you all, as I, will be interested in the rebuttal that will... I don't know about you all, but after all the things I've heard about suicide prevention centers, I think that the thought that occurred to me is that tonight our center may call you for help. If you'll allow the people in the aisles to leave first, let's take 10 minutes for a break. Okay? And now, I wanted to point out that we are back on schedule because I'm now going to thank Dr. Schneidman for his rebuttal and proceed to Dr. Saz for his rebuttal, and then we'll open it up to questions and answers. Dr. Saz.
Thank you. Is this live? Yes. Okay. Well, I would like to say first that as I understood the program, and I actually discussed this with Mrs. Ross yesterday, the structure of the program was such that if indeed it was, as I understood it to be, and as Dr. Schneidman did, that he to some extent did not play by the rules of the game already, and I would like to demonstrate that to you. I was alerted to this by a minimal clue. Dr. Schneidman likes to talk about subintentional death, which strikes me as a fancy term. I like to talk about reading English sentences, and I will read to you one in a minute. But I understood that the structure of the program was that the subject for the morning was suicide, not Dr. Schneidman and not Dr. Sass. Not the Mr. Mendel. Suicide and suicide prevention was a subject. This is what each of us was going to address ourselves to, and then we were going to have a debate. Now, this argument gains further force from the fact that Dr. Schneidman has written far more extensively about suicide and suicide prevention than I. And I could have entertained you from other quotations besides the tree analogy from his writings. But that was not the subject matter. However, he chose to discuss my various writings. But this goes further, and I would like you to pick out, those of you who have it in your pockets, this little pamphlet. And let me show you something. The fourth paragraph, there is one line, then there is another line, then there are two lines. Then there is the fourth and fifth paragraph, very short. In the fourth paragraph, there is in effect a statement which is my view on suicide and suicide prevention. In the fifth paragraph, there is a view of Dr. Schneidman's view on my view. A rather naive attempt at one-upmanship, naive in the sense that obviously he doesn't know me if he thinks he can get away with this. He's talking about killing straw men. What straw men have to be killed that stand in the way of common sense? These are highly metaphoric expressions. He's talking about throwing out babies and bathwaters. What's a baby? What's a bathwater? But in some instances, and there is two lines here. He has written God knows how many books and how many articles on suicide and suicide prevention, but he apparently did not supply one or two sentences on where he stands on this subject that can be put in plain English on a program, so that we can then discuss it. Now, let me continue with this point, because the other point, and pick up some of the specific points. He said quite clearly two statements which are remarkable at the beginning. He said that suicide is not a disease. And then he quoted from Webster's. Well, Webster's is very nice. But it's only the naivest of foreigners who think that you learn a language, that you learn the meaning of words by looking them up in dictionaries. Everybody knows that words mean how they are used. Now, if suicide is not a disease, then what do people involved in the suicide problem do in mental hospitals, treated by doctors? Then this is an obscenity, analogous to saying that Jews are not vermin. If they are not vermin, how come they are gassed? Like bed bugs.
But Dr. Saz, I didn't quote Webster's on suicide.
No, this was your own opinion,
no,
that it is not a disease.
No.
You said it's not a disease.
Well, I didn't quote Webster's on the definition of suicide.
Didn't you?
No.
Encyclopedia.
Excuse me, encyclopedia. I mean, I don't, you know. my retraction, an analogous source, I think, you know, this hardly changes what I'm saying. But if it's not a disease, ladies and gentlemen, then everything I have said holds, and there is a tremendous practical, political, civil rights issue, because interventions are daily undertaken. It is part of the mental hygiene law of virtually every state, perhaps of all 50, that if you are dangerous to yourself and others, then you are committable. In excess of 700,000 people are committed every year in this country, which means are in prison. Many of them under the subterfuge of being dangerous to themselves. Now, evidently, Dr. Schneidman doesn't believe this is true. This is fancy double talk. This is like some psychiatrist saying marijuana really isn't bad. But what does he do about it? Nothing. When people are picked up and locked up and stigmatized. So words mean, I'm simply reiterating what everybody knows, that words mean, the meaning of words is inferred from their use, from the way they are used. It's not a question of a dictionary definition. Of course, sources like non-medical sources, the ones that he has quoted, do not define suicide as a disease. I know that. I was not implying that it's defined that way in literary sources. He also said, and I don't want to digress on that, but I just want to point out that I don't agree with it. And seems to me it's a strange statement from a point of view of English usage, that it is not an immorality and it's not a moral problem. Where if dying and living, if killing oneself is not a moral problem, then I wonder what is. And I like to remind you that someone as, I think, as important, he quoted authorities, who I think are jerks. To put it mildly, because I don't think Sidney Cohen, I want to just get my 2 cents in on that because I don't want to digress on drugs, but I think people like Sidney Cohen are not experts on drug addiction. They are paid henchmen of the administration to make lies about drugs. These are not experts. I recognize experts, ladies and gentlemen. I am sure there is a textbook of pharmacology used at UC Medical Center. It's probably the same one that's used everywhere. Goodman and Gilliman. And I suggest you look up what it says about these drugs. It makes the government statements about drugs all lies. I would be perfectly happy if the government put Mimeo, would Xerox, Goodman and Gilliman on drugs and distribute that as drug education. So much for Dr. Sidney Cohen. But as far as experts, I mean, people like Camus spend the better part of their lives and writings ruminating about the importance and the nature of suicide, of the quality of life and under what circumstances is life worthwhile and what not. Now, Camus got the Nobel Prize, so obviously somebody else besides me must think that he's okay. And he certainly didn't get it for medical research. So obviously his ideas are of some merit, and obviously he treated it as a moral problem. Dr. Schneidman said clearly it's not a moral problem. It's a matter of psychological turmoil. Well, let me just hit some of the other points. He quoted Al Alvarez's recent book, about which I happen to know something, into which I won't go, but I will only mention that Mr. Alvarez's fame rests partly on the fact that he was very friendly with a person who has since become very famous, who has also been the beneficiary of wonderful psychiatric treatments, Sylvia Plath, who got the electric shock treatment for being suicidal that Dr. Schneidman says doesn't exist. So did Ernest Hemingway, got electric shock treatment against his will. Now, to run on, I took some notes as he spoke. How much time do I have?
Oh, just help yourself.
he spoke at some length about psychoanalysis and psychodynamics and all these things. And then, among other things, he said that, quotes, "I am innocent about psychodynamics." Well, that's certainly a personal statement, and it may be true or false, and I would like to tell you that I think it is false, and that I think there's a great difference between being innocent or ignorant, as he really meant it, I presume, about something, and thinking that something does not belong into this business. First of all, I do not happen to agree, but that's besides the point here, but I do not happen to believe that the unconscious, the Freudian unconscious, was a giant idea, as he called it. I think it's a giant deception also, because I think the unconscious really is, in plain English, what is inexplicit, what people do not acknowledge, do not want to admit, and actually Freud very much described it this way, so it's hardly a giant idea. But in any case, the concept of the unconscious, if it has any use at all, and by golly, it doesn't have too much use, in my opinion, but if it has any use, it has use in the area where Freud originally developed it. I mean, to use it, and that is to deal with the client or patient in the psychoanalytic, psychotherapeutic situation, in conversation with him, and to demonstrate to him that although he thinks or says that X is such and such, he really means that X is something else, and that that is in his unconscious, that it belongs in that particular realm. Now, I think to bring the idea of the unconscious into the realm, as many people have done, Franz Alexander has been a leader in this, so has Menninger, to bring it into the realm of political and legal issues is the quintessence of anti-libertarianism and anti-civil liberties. And I have charged in print in The Manufacture of Madness, and I am perfectly happy to repeat it, that the American Civil Liberties Union in the area of mental health has been nothing short of a gangster organization. With friends like this, the mental patients sure don't need enemies. And needless to say, on the board, the National Board of Directors are people like Dr. Karl Menninger, who with his brother has made a lifelong career out of locking up people and being paid for it by their families. Dr. Karl Menninger has, and William Menninger, have run an insane asylum for the last 40 years. American Civil Liberties Union does not say anything about health. In English, it says American, that's American, civil, liberties, and union. What does it say about mental health? Yet it has always minded, for the last 40 years, it has gone so far as to draft commitment statutes in the 1920s. I reference this in The Manufacture of Madness. They were actually drafting model commitment statutes, ladies and gentlemen. Now, that's no different than American civil libertarians in the 1820s drafting specifications for good plantations. Even Thomas Jefferson was in that business, drafting the Declaration of Independence and being served tea by his slaves. Nothing new about this. So the whole issue of civil liberties, I think, is a false issue that he brought, that Dr. Schneidman brought up, and brought up on the basis not of substantive argument, but on the basis of authorities. He was quoting authorities. Sidney Cohen for drugs, and the American Civil Liberties Union for the civil liberties of mental patients. Well, that, to me, is, I simply disqualify those people as authorities. They are not my authorities. And about authorities, one can't, there's no logical or intellectual discussion to be had. I mean, a person is either an authority for some unknown reason. To me, authorities on these matters are people like Locke and John Stuart Mill and Bertrand Russell and Camus. And Sartre. Now, Dr. Schneidman spoke, without elaborating, about the survivors in a typically psychiatrically paternalistic way. He spoke of the survivors of suicidal persons as though they were the legitimate clients of psychiatrists or psychologists. They are American citizens, and until they ask for help, they are none of his business, any more than mine. And by what right is he suddenly so concerned about them? Secondly, if he's so concerned about them, and he speaks about the stigma of suicide, now I would like to point out that the organization, that the reason why there is a stigma about this is precisely because of his organizations. The manufacturer... The manufacturers of medical and psychiatric stigmas for the last 200 years have been psychiatrists. They make stigma like Ford makes cars. That's the business they are in. This would hardly need documentation. After all, students in psychological institutes spend a good deal of their time reading the garbage that Freud wrote about famous people, in which he degraded them, in which Leonardo da Vinci is not a great painter, but is a feces smearer, and a homosexual, and this is a classic paper in psychiatric history, and so on, And then we talk about stigma. Well, that's where the stigma comes from.